You're listening to Evil, a true crime podcast. Join me each week as I bring you real people, real stories, real crimes, and the evil they encountered. Hey guys, it's been a minute, huh? I'm happy to be back. Sorry that I took such a long break. There's been a little bit of updates going on in my personal life that I needed to take care of. I'm going to put a timestamp in the description below if you want to just skip the small chit chat and go straight to the episode. I'll put the timestamp in the description so you can just go ahead and head straight to that if you don't want to listen to any of the small chit chat or life update. But I do feel like I did owe you guys an explanation as to why I was gone for such a long time. So as you guys know, I do have two children, A, who is my son, and you heard on one of the very first episodes that I ever did. And then I also have my 13-year-old daughter, Jay. And basically, some things happened. Well, there's some things that had been occurring in the background for several years now, that finally came to a head. And the situation is still very, very sensitive and very touchy. I also want to respect my daughter's privacy and autonomy throughout this whole situation. And then if she ever feels comfortable enough for me to discuss it, or if she ever wants to come on here and discuss it, then maybe I'll do that. But the situation was very triggering and very touchy, very sensitive. And it does have to do with just a lot of mental health and trigger warning, just some stuff that is just very icky going on in the background, and just a lot of mental health stuff that I needed to take care of in regards with my child, as far as myself as well. And I kind of just needed to take care of myself. It's hard doing this, you know. I love doing true crime. I love talking about it. I breathe, eat, sleep true crime. I really love researching the cases. I really love getting on here and talking about the victims and telling their stories. I really, really do enjoy being able to do that. But with everything that was occurring, it was really, really hard for me to sit here and focus and give my 100%. And I've always come on this mic and said that if it's not something that I can do 100%, then I'm not going to do it. And I just wasn't in the mental space to be able to handle everything that was occurring, because when I say it's a lot, it's a lot. And like I said, maybe one day I'll actually be able to get on here and tell you about all the things that were going on. But again, it's just very touchy and it's still going on. So I have to be very delicate as we move forward with possible court processing or the court process. So that's where we're at. As you guys know, I also do work two jobs. My main job just actually moved about 30 minutes from where we originally were stationed. So that's a lot too. It's cutting down on my sleep time. So there's just been a lot of things going on, and I don't want to sit here and give you guys excuses, but I did feel like I owed you guys some kind of explanation and reasoning as to why I stepped away. And that was it. That was why. But I'm back now. Like I said, the situation is still going on in the background. I just think that we have a better handle on it. Things have improved a lot than what they were a couple months ago. My mental health space is doing well. My daughter's mental health space is doing so much better. So I'm super thankful about that. So yeah, I'm hoping that you guys have been doing amazing and that life has been treating you guys well. It is June, so happy Pride Month. For me, it's always Pride. But happy Pride Month to everybody in the LGBTQ+A community. You guys know that I love you guys very, very much. And this will always be a space for you guys. You guys are always welcome here. Today, the case that I'm going to be bringing you is from Canada. It is an unsolved murder. And the case is very interesting, so I hope that you guys find it just as interesting as I did. I'm your host, Leslie, and in today's episode of Evil, we'll be diving into the chilling unsolved murder of Lindsay Buziak. On February 2, 2008, in the picturesque city of Victoria, British Columbia, a promising young real estate agent named Lindsay Buziak was called to show a luxury home to an unknown couple. Little did she know that this routine appointment would be her last. As the hours turned into days and the investigation unfolded, the horrific details of Lindsay's murder emerged, leaving investigators and the community shocked and perplexed. The meticulously planned attack appeared to have been targeted, leaving a trail of unanswered questions in its wake. Was Lindsay's death the result of a random act of violence, or was there a more sinister motive behind this heinous crime? Who were the individuals behind the masquerade of potential buyers, and what drove them to commit such a brutal act? In this episode, we'll retrace Lindsay's final moments. Precious, beautiful, vivacious, talented, fun-loving, a successful ray of sunshine is how family and friends of Lindsay Buziak described her. Lindsay Elizabeth Buziak was born on November 2, 1983. She was born to her father, Jeff Buziak, and her mother, Evelyn Rittmeyer. Her father, Jeff, worked as a real estate agent, and Evelyn worked as a stay-at-home mom. In 1986, they made Lindsay a big sister, and the couple had another daughter who they named Sarah. As a child, her mother described Lindsay as a happy little thing, smart and full of joy. Lindsay was social, but she was timid and would often cling to her mother. From a young age, Lindsay was a fashionista. She once asked Evelyn for some great bubblegum because it matched her dress. As a young teen, Lindsay got her first job at the Sirens clothing store in Mayfair Mall. The family spent summers in Lake Cowichuan, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce that, where they kept a trailer on our RV lot. There, Sarah learned how to swim because she wanted to keep up with Lindsay. In the mid-1990s, the marriage had run its course and had came undone. Evelyn was awarded primary custody of their daughters. In the early 2000s, Jeff moved to Calgary, Alberta, where he's lived ever since and now works as a commercial real estate agent. Lindsay grew up to be absolutely gorgeous, and I'm not kidding you guys. Every picture I've seen of her, she has this big, ginormous grin from ear to ear. And Lindsay was slim, with dark hair past her shoulders and brown eyes. When she was 18, Lindsay started dating Matt McDuff. Matt did do an interview where he said on Dateline that he and Lindsay had a stormy relationship, but he denied ever being physically violent towards her. A media outlet, Capital Daily, tried to reach out to Matt by phone in 2021. He declined to speak at length, saying he didn't want his daughters reading about a prior girlfriend, which I can't blame him on that. I understand why. That same media outlet, Capital Daily, followed up with him more recently, and he said he was traveling and unavailable to speak for the next few months. Lindsay's relationship with Matt ended, and shortly after, Lindsay became interested in a career in real estate. She enrolled in the UBC Sauder School of Business Real Estate Trading Services program. While there, Lindsay got help with math from Helen Jones. Helen was a real estate tutor in Victoria. You see, Helen held workshops, and at one of Helen's workshops in 2005, Lindsay ran into Jason Salo. Lindsay knew Jason from around the city. In June 2006, Lindsay passed her real estate exam. This made Lindsay one of 20 real estate agents in Greater Victoria who were estimated to be under the age of 25. For the next year and a half, Lindsay worked for a real estate company called Maverick, which was marketing townhouses in the West Shore. Oh, and remember that guy Jason? Lindsay and Jason's paths would cross again. This happened around the same time Lindsay became licensed. One friend of Lindsay, Vicky Mackey, remembers that Lindsay was impressed by the Zalos. Jason Salo is part of a prominent and wealthy family that owns a successful real estate business. Vicky remembers that Lindsay really looked up to the fact that both Jason and his mom were in real estate. That same friend also recalled that Lindsay was happy and got along with Jason's mom. She seemed excited to be part of their circle. Evelyn recalled that Lindsay specifically advertised Jason as not being a drug user. That was a big deal for her. Eventually, Lindsay joined Remax Camosan, the same brokerage that employed Shirley, Jason, and Ryan Zalo. She and Jason moved into a one-bedroom condo in the Inner Harbor owned by the Zalo family.
After starting at RE/MAX, Lindsay was involved in a property transaction that grossed a total of $3.2 million. And good for her. That's awesome. On December 15th, 2007, Lindsay visited her father in Calgary, telling him that Jason didn't seem to have the same ambitions as her. She also told other friends, including Vicky Mackey, that she wasn't happy in the relationship and that she was considering breaking it off. Jason didn't dispute that he and Lindsay had relationship troubles, but he did say that as far as he was aware of, their relationship wasn't ending. Jason was quoted as saying, "We never talked about breaking up." Lindsay's sister Sarah remembered the relationship as positive, saying the couple seemed happy and that Jason treated her well. All right, so that's a little bit of background information about Lindsay and her life. And now we're going to get into her mysterious and unsolved murder. On Friday, February 1st, 2008, Lindsay got a cold call from a 778 area code phone number. The caller was a woman with a heavy accent, who was apparently interested in buying a home. Lindsay would later describe the accent as Spanish or Mexican. The caller provided a name, but Lindsay didn't appear to have written it down in her other notes from the call. The caller explained that her husband was being transferred from Vancouver to Victoria, and they needed a brand new $1 million home. The caller had some fairly specific parameters. It needed to be immediately move-in ready, had to be within 15 to 20 minutes from town. She wanted to meet at 5:30 p.m. the next evening, tour some houses, and make an immediate purchase. When Lindsay asked the caller who had referred her, she seemed to say it was a friend of her husband's, according to court documents. After hanging up, Lindsay saved the woman's phone number in her phone as Million Dollar and began looking for properties to show. Though she had no seven-figure listings at the time, she could sell another agent's property and still make a sizable commission. While the potential for such a large sale so early on in her career excited Lindsay, she also thought that the call was weird, according to court documents. As the next 24 hours unfolded, her concerns only seemed to grow. Sometime after the initial call with Lindsay, the phone used to contact her traveled from Vancouver to Crater, Victoria. Court documents suggest police believe the person or people possessing the phone arrived on a BC ferry sailing before traveling south along a major route into the city. According to CTV Vancouver Island, the phone used to contact Lindsay arrived in Victoria the night before the murder and pinged off a cell tower near Cook and Finlayson, close to downtown. Lindsay was still awake when Jason returned to the condo around midnight. According to court documents, he and Lindsay talked about the call. He described Lindsay's mood as more inquisitive than fearful, wondering why the caller had chosen her, a new real estate agent with limited experience. Jason encouraged Lindsay to take on the client because of the high commission she would get from the sale, and to reassure her, Jason offered to be outside the property in his car in case anything went wrong. Lindsay found a suitable property and made an appointment with the client to view it at 5:30 on Saturday, February 2nd, 2008. Sometime the next morning, the would-be client called Lindsay and Jason at home. Jason said Lindsay was out and asked the woman if she wanted Lindsay's cell phone number, which the woman told Jason that she already had. To police, Jason described the caller as having a broken Spanish accent. At some point, police believed there was a 10-minute call between Lindsay and the suspect or the suspects. Although there has been speculation about why the address in Gordon Head was chosen, with some suggesting that the prospective buyers wanted to view the home specifically, police believe Lindsay provided the suspects with the address, according to court documents. Lindsay appeared to choose the Gordon Head house because it fit the caller's purported criteria and budget, which Lindsay had copied down in her day timer. And I'm going to go ahead. They do have pictures of Lindsay's day timer. So I'm going to go ahead and put it on the Instagram for you guys, okay? According to court documents, police believe the suspect or suspects may have traveled to Gordon Head ahead of time, familiarizing themselves with the area and possibly planning escape routes. At around 2 p.m. Saturday, Lindsay was at RE/MAX Camosun's head office on Chatterton Way. According to court documents, Lindsay was freaked out and asked two receptionists to search the caller's name and phone number in a company database. They were unable to find any real estate history in Greater Victoria relating to the information provided. Another colleague, Cal Faber, told Capital Daily he overheard Lindsay talking with a small group of coworkers about her new client. Cal, a former RCMP officer, said he and others who were listening to Lindsay's story offered to accompany her to the Garden Head address, but Lindsay told them not to worry, Jason was coming. She was full of confidence in the fact that her boyfriend was going to be there, Cal said. At about 3 p.m., Lindsay met Jason for lunch at a restaurant by the Inner Harbor. Jason said he remembered Lindsay eating quickly and showing him feature sheets of properties she planned to show the mystery couple. Jason said he again offered to show the properties for Lindsay, but she declined. After lunch, Lindsay went home to change and Jason went to a meeting at SHC Autograph, a nearby auto detailing shop. While in the meeting, Jason got several calls from Cohen Oatman, a friend and work colleague who played on the same hockey team as him. You see, Lindsay had plans to go to a bachelorette party in Vancouver later that night. So, Cohen and Jason were actually gonna get together and grab some beers and play hockey for a little bit while Lindsay was away. Shortly after 5 p.m., Cohen drove to SHC, left his car, and climbed into Jason's Range Rover. Sometime before 5:30 p.m., Lindsay arrived at 1702 D'Souza Place in Gordon's Head. So around 5:30 p.m., that's when a couple of things are going to start to happen. At 5:30 p.m., CCTV captured Jason, who was running late, leaving an auto shop with Cohen. The D'Souza Place cul-de-sac and house Lindsay planned to show were both so new, they didn't show up on the Range Rover's GPS. The cul-de-sac contained four houses. Number 1702 is at the outer end of the cul-de-sac on the intersection of D'Souza Place and Turquoise Drive. The side of the property and the fence of the back garden run parallel to Turquoise Drive. Around 5:30 p.m., Jason called Lindsay for directions. Lindsay was about to provide them when the potential clients appeared. "Oh, I've got to go, they're here," she told Jason before hanging up. Jason asked Lindsay to text him for the directions. Despite the client telling Lindsay that she would come alone, a couple turned up for the viewing. Around the same time, multiple eyewitnesses said they saw Lindsay shaking hands with a couple. The male was tall with dark hair and a long jacket. The female had short blonde hair and wore a swirling black and red dress. Lindsay let them inside the house and the showing began. A few minutes later, the tour headed upstairs. Lindsay sent Jason a text with directions to the house. Jason, meanwhile, had phoned his brother for directions and was making his way there. The main bedroom was at the top of the stairs. As Lindsay turned to show the ensuite bathroom, she was stabbed from behind with an edged weapon. There were multiple stab wounds, nicks, and cuts on Lindsay's body, including her chest and abdomen. There are reports that she was stabbed somewhere between 40 to 50 times, but that has yet to be confirmed. And some people that are close to the case say it's misinformation. The attack triggered a pocket dial at around 5:41 p.m., to a friend of Lindsay's who she was not in regular contact with, which resulted in a muffled voicemail message, according to Staff Sergeant Chris Horsley. Immediately after the stabbing, the suspects left the scene. A trail of bloody footprints were found on the staircase, according to court documents. The suspect or suspects were in the process of regathering their shoes, apparently planning to walk out the front door, when Jason and Cohen showed up and cast the man in the Range Rover's headlights. Believing the showing had just begun, Jason drove past the house as the man receded through the entry, presumably towards the rear of the house. Because Jason said Lindsay asked him to not make his presence known, so he didn't interfere with the showing. Jason turned around in the driveway of a nearby house under construction and left the cul-de-sac to park a short distance away. Jason said he saw no sign of movement inside the house. He texted Lindsay asking if she was okay, but she didn't respond. After another few minutes, Jason said he repositioned his Range Rover closer to the house and tried calling her. Lindsay didn't answer. At around 6 p.m., after getting no response from Lindsay, Jason and Cohen got out of the vehicle and walked up to the front entrance. The door was locked. Jason said he rang the doorbell repeatedly, but no one answered. He said he tried paging the listening agent, and then he called his mother for the agent's cell number. When Jason explained what was going on, the agent gave him the code for the garage. Jason tried the code, but it didn't work. There was another door around the side of the house, but it was locked. Jason asked Cohen what he should do and whether they should break a window or not. Cohen told Jason to call the police. Through the glass on the front door, he could see Lindsay's shoes in the entrance hall, but there was no sign of movement and no one answered his repeated knocks at the door. At 6:05 p.m., Jason dialed 911, explaining the situation and adding that he had followed Lindsay to the house because she was kind of scared. Around that same time, Cohen signaled to him from the side of the house, where there was a patio. Over the top of a wooden fence, Cohen and now Jason saw a set of open French doors that led out from the kitchen and dining area into the enclosed backyard. After exiting the back door, the suspect or suspects may have escaped through a gap in the fence. Jason boosted Cohen over the fence. Cohen ran through the yard and into the empty house, unlocking the front door from the inside. Jason ran around from the back of the house and met him at the front. Once inside the foyer, Jason and Cohen split up. Cohen took the bottom floor and Jason ran upstairs, yelling Lindsay's name frantically. Partway up the stairs, Jason told Capital Daily that he could already see Lindsay slumped against the bedroom wall. God, that's so horrific. Can you even imagine? Jeez. According to court documents, Lindsay was lying in a large pool of blood. Cohen, who Jason had summoned, made a second call to 911 at 6:11 p.m., explaining they needed an ambulance right away. Jason tried to perform CPR, but it was too late. Lindsay was pronounced dead when the paramedics arrived. There were no defensive wounds indicating that she had probably been initially stabbed from behind and that she had no inkling of what was about to happen. None of Lindsay's possession had been stolen and she had not been sexually assaulted. So poor Lindsay, she just shows up to sell this house and has no idea that this is going to be her last moment on earth and these people just savagely attack her for no reason. It's absolutely... it's just wild. Like, what? I can't even imagine. Jason said he was in shock and that he still agonizes over arriving too late. Quote, I think about it all the time. If I was 10 minutes earlier, if I went with her, would she still be alive? Jason and Cohen were taken into custody but were released without charge after their version of events was verified and the timestamped surveillance footage from the auto shop proved that they could not have committed the murder. Jason said he cooperated with investigators, took part in a polygraph test, and turned over his phone and laptop he and Lindsay shared. Jason spoke to police multiple times and agreed to participate in a filmed reenactment of how he and Cohen discovered Lindsay, which you can find the YouTube of him doing the reenactment online. It's on YouTube. Jeff Buziak, Lindsay's dad, did an interview with Dateline, and he basically said that he didn't feel like Jason showed outward signs of grief following the murder. However, Sarah Buziak, who is Lindsay's sister, told Capital Daily that she worked for Jason after the murder and that Jason was hurt, confused, and sad. Sarah said that she was also interviewed by Dateline, but that her interview wasn't included in the final version of the episode. Sarah also said she didn't watch any of the shows or listen to podcasts about her sister's murder. Quote, if I was to listen to what other people said or claim they knew, it would probably drive me crazy, end quote. And to that, Sarah, I say I cannot blame you for not listening to this podcast or any other podcast about your sister's murder. Due to the complete lack of DNA, fingerprints, or any other physical evidence at the scene, it is believed that the murder was well organized and carried out by people who had perhaps killed before. The police believed that the killers were leaving through the front door when Jason drove up to the property and that they then fled through the back door, leaving the back patio doors open and passing through the fence and back to a vehicle, which was presumably parked somewhere on or near Turquoise Drive. This is consistent with witness statements of the unknown couple walking rather than driving up to the cul-de-sac, and that the fact that all the vehicles on the cul-de-sac once the police arrived were accounted for. The family of Jason Salo was investigated due to their connections with the cul-de-sac. D'Souza Court is named after developer Joe D'Souza, a friend and business associate of Shirley Salo, Jason's mother. Part of the cul-de-sac was still under construction at the time of the murder, and D'Souza himself was at the location an hour before the murder, supervising the construction work. However, police have stated that no one in the Zalo family is a suspect. Again, I repeat, police have stated that no one in the Zalo family is a suspect. In a 2012 blog post, Jeff said that he had just discovered a letter Lindsay left him that named people and described things that were going on prior to her death. Quote, she explains what she saw that she shouldn't have. End quote, he wrote. Though no letter has ever publicly surfaced, Jeff has continued to claim that Lindsay, quote, saw something and presented different theories and explanations about what it could be. More recently, Jeff said that it was during a trip to see him in Calgary in December 2007 that Lindsay told him or gave him the impression that she saw something she shouldn't have, but said that Lindsay wouldn't tell him what it was. Lindsay's mom, Evelyn, said Lindsay never mentioned seeing anything to her. I've talked to a lot of her girlfriends, she said. Nobody's ever said anything like that. Evelyn also said she contacted the police after learning that her ex-husband had apparently discovered the letter, which Jeff said he had turned over to the authorities. Evelyn said police told her that they had never received it. Police gave Lindsay and Jason's Toshiba laptop to the RCMP's Technological Crime Unit. The officer who studied the computer, Paul Brooks, found that the data related to internet chat communications had recently been deleted, according to court documents. The missing data came from the My Documents part of the hard drive, where there was a folder called My Received Files. That folder, Brooks explained, was empty. Brooks also said that he had found a page file on the computer that contained past word processing activities, emails, and internet browsing activity. Though Brooks' account is still partially redacted, he concluded there were chat messages at one time, but they have since been erased. Brooke was unable to determine when that erasure happened. A different officer who studied Lindsay's Facebook page noticed that none of Lindsay's 700 friends posted any messages on her wall between January 24th and February 3rd, 2008. The officer found this very odd and inconsistent with Lindsay's unusual pattern of activity, according to court documents. So, was somebody on Lindsay's computer? And if so, who and why and what were they deleting? On closer inspection, however, police appear to believe messages had been deleted. In court documents filed by police on March 25th, 2008, to support their request for a court order requiring Facebook and Inc. to produce certain records, police argued that obtaining deleted wall messages could yield important information. What Facebook provided back is unclear, but the notes made by Saanich police officers after reading about Facebook, still a new social media platform, suggests Lindsay or someone with access to Lindsay's Facebook account may have deleted messages. Wall messages may be deleted, the officer noted, but only the user may delete messages posted on their own wall through the use of their own account. So, the plot thickens. Again, was there somebody on her Facebook? And if so, who was on her Facebook? And why were they deleting messages? And what were they deleting? Previously, Staff Sergeant Chris Horsley told the Time Colonist police had investigated Lindsay's online social media chats, even those that she deleted, and found nothing related to any crime or potential motive. When Lindsay's friends and family were asked about the missing messages, they had no explanation. Police kept racking their brains trying to find a motive for Lindsay's murder. Eventually, police came up with a theory that Lindsay had been falsely identified as a person who informed on a drug operation. So basically a snitch. The theory was based on several events, including Lindsay's trip to see her father in Calgary in December 2007. A few weeks after her visit near the end of January 2008, Calgary police raided a house in the northwest part of the city, kicking off a year-long investigation dubbed Operation High Noon. That investigation led to the seizure of 80 kilograms of cocaine worth $8 million, according to news reports, and was described at the time as the largest ever cocaine bust in Alberta's history. There is no evidence that Lindsay was connected to the seizure. She was not a drug user, according to multiple sources. So I just want to make that very clear. She was not a drug user, according to multiple sources, and she was known to have an anti-drug stance. There is also no indication Lindsay informed police about it, and police have said there is no evidence Lindsay was involved in any kind of criminal activity. After returning home from her Calgary trip, Lindsay visited the Facebook page of a relative of someone involved in the drug operation and tried to contact the person by phone, according to Crime Watch Daily. As Staff Sergeant Chris Horsley explained on the show, we don't know the nature of the call, we don't know why she called him, we don't know why she was on his Facebook site. It was speculated that Lindsay's murder may have been ordered by a drug cartel because she was believed to be a police informant. The detectives investigated the possibility but quickly ruled it out as a motive because she was not an informant and the personal nature of her murder did not fit a hired killer's method of operation, meaning it's not usually how they kill, usually what they do, usually their desired, their style of killing, possibly saying it's too messy. Crime scene investigator Yolanda McCleary and veteran homicide detective Dwayne Stanton both agree that Lindsay's murder was not a contracted murder related to a drug cartel. They believe that it was brutal, but it was too amateurish. Both seasoned investigators believe that Lindsay's murder was very personal and planned by someone very close to her, someone who had access to inside information from the RE/MAX office where she worked. So, again, I'm going to say this one more time. They believed that it was very personal and planned by somebody that was very close to her, who had access to inside information from the RE/MAX office. RE/MAX office. I don't know why I could not say that. Where she worked. So I just thought it was super interesting that both of these investigators thought that it was not a hit, that it had to do with someone who had personal information regarding Lindsay and her whereabouts, possibly somebody that worked with her. So I thought that was super insightful and interesting. Speculation regarding another drug bust related to this group of people who was also investigated as a link to Lindsay's murder. An individual's phone had been tapped because of his high levels of involvement in the trafficking and sale of illegal narcotics in British Columbia and Alberta. During the wiretaps, law enforcement uncovered information that led to the BC legislature raids in 2003. Lindsay and her boyfriend's phone at the time were also tapped because of his association with this group. Although this theory was interesting, it was quickly dismissed because Lindsay was never known to be involved in drug use or trafficking. It was not on the witness list related to the defense during the trial. In 2008, a close friend of Lindsay called Nikki claimed that she was awakened by a telephone call in the middle of the night from an unknown number. As she was half asleep, she did not register much of what the female caller was saying, but she noticed that the caller had a strange accent that she could not place. She became scared when she remembered that Lindsay had reported that her unidentified client and possible murderer had an odd accent that she could not put her finger on, and which she thought might be fake. Now fully alert, she called the number back, but no one picked up. She called repeatedly, 20 or 30 times, until someone answered. The person on the other end of the phone line was Shirley Zalo. Nikki asked Shirley why she had her number and why she had called her and how she had her number, as they didn't know each other. Shirley replied that she meant to call another Nikki, her secretary, and that she didn't know why this Nikki's number was in her contact list, but presumed that her son Jason must have added it. Shirley Salo categorically denies that this event occurred, and it has not been publicly revealed whether Nikki's claim was followed up by the authorities or not. In 2022, Shirley Salo sued Jeff Buziak and two supporters for defamation in the BC Supreme Court, alleging they had published or arranged to have published numerous posts that falsely accused her of murder on the website lindsaybuziakmurder.com. In a court filing responding to the lawsuit, Jeff denied the allegations. He denied ever seeing, authorizing, or jointly publishing any of the words Shirley complained about. Jeff also denied that the words had the defamatory meanings that Shirley alleged, and denied that Shirley had suffered any damage or loss. Finally, Jeff pointed to a disclaimer posted on the website that said, "Information on this site is from personal opinions and cannot be guaranteed or warranted by the site or its administrators in any way," and relied on the fact that the words Shirley complained about had been removed from the site. The allegations in Shirley's lawsuit have not yet been tested or proven in court. The Zalo said post about their family had damaged their business and brought them close to the brink. "I went through a bad part in my family," Shirley told Capital Daily. "I don't want to go back there." Jason Zalo said his family has had enough. "You shouldn't just be able to just throw people's name out there and call them, you know, murderers and all the awful things that they've said with no knowledge or with no proof." Shirley's lawsuit is not the first time Jeff has been confronted about alleged false claims. In 2017, two volunteers who had been administrators for the website for years quit working for Jeff, accusing him of feeding them misinformation related to Lindsay's murder and saying they could no longer support him. In February of each year, Lindsay's father, Jeff, leads an annual walk in remembrance of Lindsay and to help keep her case alive in the public eye. In August 2017, a public message board comment was posted on the investigated website run by Jeff Buziak. The message, which contained misspellings throughout, stated, "I killed Lindsay and stupid cops will never prove it." Now, I've tried to see and look all over the place to see what happened of this, and I'm pretty sure that it ended up to be a hoax. Why people do this, I don't understand. It's really sick and disgusting and just disgraceful and disrespectful to the victim. And it just re-traumatizes the victim's family, so just gross. In 2020, Capital Daily requested a release of public records relating to Lindsay's case and reported previously unpublished information. The documents revealed that police were aware of two different crime phones used by the suspects, one with a Vancouver number only used to contact Lindsay and another used to check the voicemail of the first phone. They also reported strange internet activity during the time just before her murder, and that the police initially suspected that violent criminals on her Facebook friends list may have played a role in the murder. In February 2021, Saanich police said that the advancements in DNA analysis and other technology had created new leads in the case. The United States Federal Bureau of Investigation has been working with the investigators on the case since early 2020. As I conclude this episode, I want to reflect on Lindsay's tragic case. Lindsay's story serves as a haunting reminder of the darkness that can infiltrate even the most seemingly ordinary lives. We've delved into the details surrounding Lindsay's untimely death, piecing together the evidence and examining the investigation. The heinous crime that claimed her life remains unsolved, leaving her loved ones and investigators with lingering questions and a sense of injustice. Despite the darkness that surrounds this case, we must not forget Lindsay's vibrant spirit and the impact that she had on those who knew her. Her memory lives on in the hearts of her family and friends, who continue to seek justice and remember the light that she brought into their lives. And that's it, guys. That is the case of Lindsay Buziak. Thank you so much for joining me. If you or anyone you know has any information regarding Lindsay's case, contact 250-475-4356 or toll free at 1-888-980-1919 to provide any information you may have, no matter how small it may seem. So thank you again for joining me. I will catch you guys next time. I love you so much. And as always, watch out for evil. To stay connected, follow our Instagram at evilpodcast88, also on TikTok at evilpodcast, and our Twitter is at evilpodcast88. Comment, like, share, review, give us a rating, let us know what you think.